Sorry if I feel so disconnected. I'm just really exhausted this week for some reason. So I hope we're getting through and getting some stuff done, because I want you to know that I really am on a very magical journey, and so are you. I want to remind you again that, because it fits so many people in this room, of that movie Contact. Someone else came to me about it, and because he really likes it too, he swears by it. I love it when she's there with her dad, or a guy representing her dad, and he's saying to her, "You're an interesting species, an interesting mix. You are so capable of such beautiful dreams and such horrible nightmares. You feel so lost, so cut off, so alone, only you're not. See, in all our searching, the only thing we've found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other. And that's why it's important for me to be with you, and important for me to talk to you, to not keep it all within myself, because you and I can solve this thing. If we'll just get together and lay it out on a table someplace, or maybe in a group or whatever. And it's why we love so much being with one another, because we're all connected. We're all connected by that silver thread. You know, everybody in this room and everybody and everything everywhere is connected. So none of us is alone. Anyway, we've come to probably, I think, the most rewarding step of all, other than step two, being able to find what I determined to be the location of God, you know, for me. That he's as close as my next breath, and that I consult him at any single time. And that was so important for me to find that wherever I am, he is. You know, I cannot go anywhere without him. The fact that I ask him to go out that door with me is just, you know, it's just that. Nothing more than that. He has to go with me because that was made that way. He's woven into me, woven into my tapestry, woven into my being, woven into my DNA. Isn't that an interesting thought, that God's DNA and mine are the same? How do you like that one, you know? And anyway, and I believe all of those things. You know, I don't have to convince you or whatever, but over the years I've been convinced that what I'm telling you is the truth, and I have no reason to tell you otherwise. You know, I'm obligated to tell you what happened to me. So, these amends were so, so important. And amends are very, very intuitive. You don't get to decide which one you're going to do. It occurs to you when it's time for you to do them. You take out your stack of cards in the morning, and you simply say the little prayer. I mean, we're either talking to something real or we're not, okay? And if we're not, like I said earlier, let's go get a bottle of gin and go down and have a good time on the beach, you know? But we're not. We're talking to something real, something that's listening. So I tell him, please take me to my next amends and give me the power to make it, you know? So, I'll give you an illustration on that. I was down at my mother's. I got to make amends with my mother before she died. And it was such a phenomenal feeling. And I sat down with her, and she listened very carefully to every single thing that I said. And she had that wonderful little look on her face. And I asked her, I said, "Mother, do you need to tell me about how any of this made you feel?" And she told me briefly how it made me feel. And I said, "What can I do to make this right, Mother?" And she looked at me and she said, you can hang around those people you're with. You go and be with them." Because she said, "Those people gave me my son back. So you need to be with them. We understand. As a family, we would like you around for this and that and whatever. But you go where you needed to go. We want you to be with those people. My family loved me. I nearly drove them crazy. You know, right up to the very end, those poor people just didn't have a chance. I made so, so many amends to them. And when I was leaving my mother's house, I was coming up Pacific Coast Highway, and I got to the corner of Marine and Pacific Coast Highway, and I got an idea that said, "You're directly in line with the city of Manhattan Beach. this, City Hall. And I said, well, damned if I'm not. Every time I drove through the city of Manhattan Beach, I would remember when I was 15 years old with a bunch of guys, we all were playing in the park and breaking the branches of the trees and falling down in the flower beds and all of that, you know. And so I ordered them into the city of Manhattan Beach, and so I went down there and I parked my car. I went in, and I said, "I'd like to see the person in charge of Department and Recreation, the Department of Recreation," and she said, "Parks and Recreation." She said, "Well, she's busy right now. Could you sit down and wait a minute?" So I sat down, and pretty soon this little blonde, about 20 years old, pops her head around the corner and says, "Mr. Wood, I'll see you now." So I went in, and she's the person in charge, right? Department of Parks and Recreation. She's got toys, puzzles, so much stuff piled all over her. She barely has enough room for me to sit down and her to get in here, you know. And she's sitting there playing with a pencil and has the eraser in her mouth. And she says, "How can I help you, Mr. Wood?" And I said, "Well, I came here in hopes that I can help you." And I said, "You know, when I was 15 years old, I was here with a bunch of guys, and we were all drinking and carrying on and falling out of the tree, and we fell over in the flower beds and ruined all these plants that had been planted there." And I said, "You know what? We don't believe in tearing up things that are beautiful. And I came here today to try to make amends with the city of Manhattan Beach and pay that money back, you know, if I possibly can." And I said, "I figure that my part in that was probably around $200. So I came here to give you $200 today if you'll take it, you know." Here's why I found out that amends are not just for you. They're for the other person too, you know. Because she was sitting there and she had bluest eyes, just like my sister, bluest eyes on the planet. And she said, tears going down her eyes. She says, "Mr. Wood, I was having a really bad day till you came. And I got it, you know, I understood that." Same thing with my sister. My sister sat there and my brother-in-law. Funny thing is I made amends with them together, which is not something I planned to do. And my sister and my brother-in-law said to me, "You've got to stop." My brother-in-law wouldn't cry. You can't make him cry, right? My brother-in-law said to me, "You've got to stop this." He had tears coming down his cheeks. And I said, "I can't stop this. I can't finish. I can't stop this until I've done. I have to get it all out." And so I did. And my sister looked at me and she said, "Bo, I have loved you all my life. I wanted to marry somebody like you." She said, "I wanted to come and see you toward the end of your drinking, but I was afraid to come because I was afraid I might find you dead." And that's everyone left me alone at the end. I had no visitors. Nobody was coming. It was just me and a bottle of Tokay wine and people coming in my house and stealing everything that wasn't nailed down on the ground floor, you know. Anyway, those are how amends are really, really intuitive. I remember a Sunday, I was, you know when that, like I said earlier, that voice, you know that voice when you hear it. And I was coming, we were in the marina, I was coming down into the living room. Pat Wood loves to read the newspaper. She's like an addict. She reads the newspaper from the front page to the back. She reads all of the advertisements and everything. She knows anybody that's sleeping with him, whoever, you know, in the movie business or what. She knows that paper from front to back. And as I'm coming down into the living room, I hear this voice say, "It's time to make amends to Pat now." And I thought, you know. And so I said, "Can I talk to you for a minute?" And she put her newspaper down and I said, "I need just a few minutes of your time. I need to talk to you." And she said, "Okay." So here's what I had done. When we were living over in Tucson and our marriage was over and all of that, she was in the process of working these steps at the time. And she came to me during the process, when we were no longer speaking and all of that. She came to me, though, she had an amends to make to me, and she started to make amends with me. And after she was finished, I said to her, "I accept your amends, but I don't forgive you." You know? So, now I have to make amends to her, you know? And she's sitting there like, "Well?" And so I start in, and oh God, I cried and carried on and told her how sorry I was, you know, because I learned with Pat Wood, above all people, that it doesn't matter who's right anymore. It doesn't matter. I don't care who's right anymore. You want to be right? Go be right. It's fine. I'm not going to argue with you. Go be right. I learned that by going to work one morning. I was going up the 405. I get to Wilshire Boulevard, and I see a van over here that's overturned in the road, and about six people are spilled out into the road, and the engine's smoking, you know? The first thought that I had was, those people thought they were coming home tonight, you know? And Pat and I had an argument just before she left for work, and when she shut the door, my heart stopped, because I thought, God damn it, I didn't clean that up before she left, you know. And so now it's Monday morning. Pat's in the stock market. She's was in it 50 years. She's high up in the company. Monday morning's a big day in the stock market. They have a phone they never hang up. It's all over the world. People are talking all over the world, stocks and bonds and trading and this and that and blah, 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 you know. And so you can't reach Pat Wood at any given time on Monday morning. You cannot do it. Now, I have to leave, you know, these people are out in the street, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I haven't made this amends to her, and so I get to work knowing that I can't speak with her, that she's just not there. And I dial the number anyway, I dial her personal number, and I hear her say, "Pat Wood." Jesus Christ. I started to cry. I unloaded on her and I said, "I am so sorry." You know, I'll tell you the thing about this. I was actually right that that Monday. I was right. Now, I'll tell you today even, if I expect Pat Wood to apologize to me, I'm going to be really, really old with a long, long beard, because she just doesn't do it. It took me a long time to discover that she actually loved me, and she loved me as much as she can love me. She doesn't love me like I love her, but she loves me, you know, and I accept all of that, and I forgive a whole lot of stuff, because that's just the way she is. And, you know, while we were living down there in Marina Del Rey, right after, you know, when I asked her, I said, "What can I do to make this right?" She says, "You can keep talking to me this way. I can live with you if you talk to me. If you communicate with me, you learn how to do that, I can live with you," you know. So I've been learning this stuff all along here, all along the way. It was a morning, I came out to the living room one morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning, and she was sitting there with her knees drawn up, and just a terrible looking on her face in pain, you know. I said, "What's the matter with you?" I said, do you have an appendix?" She said, "Yes." And I said, "You have appendicitis." And I called her doctor, and he said, "Get her to emergency right now." So I got her over to emergency. It took them 7 hours to take her in. During that time of waiting, she had thrown up all over herself, all of her clothes, everything. I'd taken her clothes off, cleaned her body, put a clean robe on her, all that, stood out in the hallway with her. It was just packed. The place was like mobbed. It was Torrance Memorial Hospital over there, you know? And so finally, we get her upstairs in a room, and I keep saying she has appendicitis. Better, you know, operate. She has appendicitis. And they don't pay attention to me, fortunately, because by the time they got her on the operating table, they discovered that her appendix wasn't, you know, they decided to do an exploratory operation, which was perfect, because they cut down the middle of her, and then, and when they opened her up, this appendix had moved from where it normally is, and had formed a big ball of pus and stuff there, and was getting ready to explode at that time, and they took it out. And She almost died on me. She was in terrible, terrible trouble for quite some time with that. They sent her home finally with an open wound, you know, because they can't close that kind up. It's very dangerous. It has to close up on its own. You have to take really good care of it. They sent her home with a nurse, and you have to take the bandages off, clean everything out, scrape everything out, pull all the gauze up out of the wound, and then boil it out with hydrogen peroxide, you know, and then put it all back in. And that, 3 times a day, you had to do that. And I fired the nurse about the third day, because I come in and she's fiddling with her fingernails and her hair and stuff, and I'm thinking, wait a minute here, you know, you can't do this. I was afraid she would let her die. So I fired her, and I decided that I would take over both positions. You know, I would take over taking care of her and also going to work and driving my car one day and driving her car another day. And I did that for 3 months. Now, I'm not good at doing something like on a long-term basis. I am also not good at doing something like this. I mean, do you understand that this is called gangrene? That's what she had. And gangrene is rotten flesh, and it smells like it, you know. And I was able to do that 3 times a day and clean all of that out and tell her, in all honesty, you look a little better. You know, and I remember, it was so funny, she has a great sense of humor, because one day she says to me, "Oh, Louis, I was changing her bandages and everything." She says, "You're so good to me." And I said, you'd do the same for me, Pat. And she looked at me and said, "Well, I'd see you'd get the best care money could buy." That's about the best of that. But, and there's another side of that story, and I'll tell you what it is. Because when we moved over to the valley in Palm Desert, where we lived, and Rancho Mirage at that time, I had a big house then and a big master bath and all of that. And because the day finally came when she could take care of herself, you know, and I didn't have to do all of that. But one morning, I was coming in the bathroom, and she was coming up out of the shower. I don't know if you've ever seen an exploratory operation scar. They're not pretty at all, you know. And so she was coming out, and I was coming in, and she ducked like that, and she went down and covered up that scar so I couldn't see it. And I said, "You know what? I have to tell you something right now. I have to tell you about that scar. Because I don't see that scar the way you do. I know how you see it. I don't see it that way at all." I said, all of our married life, I've always believed that you could do better than me. You know? And I said, after all of this, and taking care of you for all that length of time, keeping your clothes clean and your body clean, and feeding you the best food money could buy, I said, you can't do better than me. I believe that, you know. I said, so that's what that scar represents to me. I don't see it the way you do at all, you know. So these are so many ways of getting healed and mended along the way. If we just keep in there, keep on the firing line of life here. I told you about my sister and brother-in-law. I also made amends to her boys, they were like 5 when I was going through their lives. And I remember I said to Scott when I sat down with him, I said, "You probably don't remember this, but, you know," and then he listened to me for a little. He said, "Oh, I remember very well." And then he began to tell me all of these things that he had seen. Like Rick and I were just talking about his little boy. You know, they see a lot at 5 and 6 years old. And boy, he'd get me a, you know, so we got all that mended and fixed it and fixed up here. There was, you don't have to really worry so much about, did I get them all down on paper? Did I get them all? Did I cover them, each and every one? You don't have to worry about that, because I'm going to tell you, we are part of a tremendously generous God here. And it will get handed to you one way or another. I owed an amend to a guy named Pete Espinosa. And I can get so pissy sometimes. I said, I don't know where Pete Espinosa lives. You know, it just came out of the blue. And it says, try the internet. So I get on the internet and I'm looking for Pete Espinosa, and I found five of them. One was in Oxnard and a few other places. And one was down in Mission Viejo. And I called the one in Oxnard. It was a Spanish-speaking family, and that was not him. And then I called a few others. It was not him. And the last one didn't have a phone number. So I wrote a letter, and I said, I don't know that if you're the Pete Espinosa I'm looking for. But I said, you would have been manager of a market, Clark's Market, over in Manhattan Beach. And I said, when I needed a job, you gave me one. And I said, I need to talk to you. And so I left him my name, my number, all that on the phone. And I get home on Friday, and there's the phone call that says, Luther, this is Pete. And call me up, blah, blah, blah. So I called him up, and he's real suspicious, like, what does he want, you know? And I said, Pete, I need to come down and see you. I need to come and talk to you. And so he made an appointment with me on Monday, and I drove down to, he was living in that Rossmore Leisure World down there in the Mission Viejo. And I went down there and got there about noon, and his wife was sitting at the table, and he was there, big, strapping, dark-skinned guy, big black eyes like Einstein, you know. So heck of a nice guy. And anyway, he greeted me at the door, and we sat down, and we got to talking, and we're laughing about old times and people we worked with. And you ever hear from Dottie? No. And did you ever hear from this and that? And no. And so his wife says, Luther, what brings you here today? And I said, before I could get it out, Pete says to me, you remember Jim Allen? And I said, yeah, I remember him. And he said, you know, he got fired for stealing. And I said, oh, really? I said, well, funny you should bring that up, Pete. I came down here today because when I really needed a job, you gave me one. And I said, how I paid you back is I stole from you, you know? And I said, I figured that it came to about $1,500. And I came here to see if you were responsible for any of this. Because if you were, I came here to pay you back too. And he said, he was sitting there, a big guy, like I tell you, and he had tears streaming down his face. And he said, Luther Wood, my opinion of you has shot up about 1,000% since you came in this door. And he said, I really appreciate your offer, but I don't need it. He said, I'm not responsible for any of that. We have insurance that takes care of all that stuff. And so we became fast friends again, you know, right then and there, you know, out of all of this. But I got to tell you about the other side of the $1,500, see? Clint and I were together. I said, what will I do with the money? And I finally saved it until I had $1,500. So I said, what will I do with the money? And he said, oh, I don't know, maybe you should give it to Boys Town. And I thought about that for a while. And then I thought about giving it to Clancy and the Mission. And the thing of it is that I had to give it away anonymously, you know, as far as I was concerned. I didn't want anybody to know where it came from or whatever. I believe God lives in Bel Air, because every time I go over the 405 to get to Mulholland, you know, I hear this whisper in my ear or whatever. So, voice says, call Herb Coddington about this $1,500. And I'm thinking, call Herb Coddington, somebody I barely knew. Herb Coddington was a little minister down in Clinton, South Carolina, that my mother liked. My mother would send money or bought them an altar and bought them this and bought them that. And, you know, she loved that little place. I went down there with her a few times. And but I've learned to be obedient here. I just be obedient. I called Herb Coddington and got him on the phone, and I said, Herb, you may not remember me, but I told him about my mother, Thelma. He says, I remember you. I remember you very well. And I said, you know, I said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Part of my program is being able to make amends to things that I've done. What I'm going to tell you is I have $1,500 that I have saved, and for whatever reasons, I'm supposed to call you and ask you if you would take it. This is not an esteemable act. I don't want any paperwork. I don't want you telling me that I can take the sum of my income tax or whatever, you know. I said, I'm trying to pay back a wrong that I did in the universe. And I said, I only have a few stipulations to this money, and if you'll take it. And he said, what are the stipulations? I said, well, you have to buy somebody a pair of shoes. I said, because when times were hard, I took a boy's shoes and put them in a lake, you know, and just being an asshole, and ruined the shoes. Got a black eye for it, too, anyway, so I said, you got to buy somebody a pair of shoes. And I said, when I lived in Paris, I went to the Sorbonne University. The woman who lent us her apartment while she was on sabbatical, I went through and pilfered a bunch of stuff for hers, textbooks and things like that that I took. So you got to buy somebody some textbooks. And I knew Clinton is a college town, so there'd be easy to buy textbooks and stuff like that. And I said, other than that, you don't have to tell me a thing about anything. I don't want any paperwork, no nothing. You don't have to send me anything, you know. So he agreed to that, and he was just flabbergasted when I sent him the money. And along about, I don't know, a month or so later, he sends me a little card here. He said, greetings. Thanks so much for your very generous and timely gift. It was a real boost to us, not only because of the amount, but because your interests so closely corresponded to the needs here. Let me illustrate. I just placed an order for 95 French books. French language books to a bookstore in Montreal for teachers in Haiti. We will have 8 rather poor Dominicans joining us for semester camp here in Clinton in June. We're covering their expenses, which will likely include clothing and shoes. Our folks going to Haiti and the Dominican Republic are in need of assistance to purchase tickets. During our summer camp in Clinton, we subsidize registration fees for those unable to pay, etc. I think you get the point. We'll keep you posted. Gratefully, Herb. So, and he sends me all, you know, they put that kind of a notice in their church mess and everything, you know, on Sunday morning when they all go in for prayer and all that. So, you know, I didn't think much more of it, but except for I thought that so much good could come from so much bad, and that's how the power works, you know, because I got another one of these. It said, thanks again for your investment in our summer ministries. Your shoe idea caught fire. We sent 100 pair to impoverished kids in Haiti and 100 books to 90 teachers there. We took clothing to kids in the Dominican Republic and had productive ministry in the Clinton area as well. See enclosed article. Gratefully, Herb. And so he sent me this article. And the article is all about what they're doing down in Haiti and stuff. And how this $1,500 helped them all get rolling, and they produced a newspaper on top of it as you know, with some of the money too. It's like seed money. It all keeps just gathering speed. It's like a snowball rolling downhill, you know. So I got another one that says, thanks for your kind and exciting letter. It's great to hear what the Lord is doing in and through you. Enclosed is a note I have mailed out to some who are interested in our summer program. Fondly, Herb. And he goes on to talk about the tent who went to Haiti to teach 90 teachers and pastors did a splendid job. Mission Possible, which hosts 20 teams a year in Haiti, called it their finest team and has already scheduled us for next year. In addition to teaching all day, the team did ministry in the evenings and helped to transport water to a village with no nearby water supply and made available 100 new pairs of sneakers and 10,000 new articles of clothing. God was obviously present in the work. And all I'm trying to tell you is, like, something so insignificant and so little, you can't believe that how it multiplies. You know, it just keeps gathering, more and more ground. I got another one from them. It says, thank you and Pat for your lovely card. Thank you for remembering us during this time of year. It was Christmas. Let me take the opportunity to catch you up on a few things. It talks about my cousin here, but then he says, what I did was, one year, we needed a tax write-off. And I had a few acres of land down there with oak and all that stuff all over it. You know, stream running through it, went on and on and on. I knew I was never going to live in South Carolina again. And we needed a write-off that year. So by December 31st, I had quit claim the deed to these people for this property. And so eventually they sold this property, and the church has recently sold, and the realtors are sorting through the paperwork at this time. The proceeds will be applied to an addition to the church facility. Thank you so very much. And then he says, do you remember the generous gift you gave us for books and shoes for Haitian children several years ago? That turned out to be seed money for a growing involvement. Haiti and the Dominican Republic. We go down often to do teacher and pastor seminars, seeing closings, enclosure, blessings, Herb. And then he shows me this newspaper of all the stuff they're doing in this area. So just these little things that we do along the way that seem so insignificant, where a little blonde-haired girl can look at you and say, Mr. Wood, I was having a bad day till you came. That's who we are. We're the bearer of good tidings instead of what we used to be, because all we were was trouble. You know, every place we went was trouble. People did not want to see us coming. We were not welcome anymore. We were turned away, and hopefully that we would never show up again. Then I had, I was also going over Mulholland one day, and God said from Bel Air, what about Bob Taylor? And I thought, Bob Taylor? What about Bob Taylor? I have no idea where he is. Bob Taylor was a roommate of mine when I lived down in the Strand at Hermosa Beach. And I loved him because he was never there on the weekend. He had a girlfriend, and they went off slalom racing all weekend, you know. So I had the whole weekend to my place, to myself, and had a party every single, the place was destroyed every single weekend that Bob Taylor wasn't there. And he would come back to all this mess and everything, and I would have clean it up and try to keep the peace and so on and so forth. And so I thought, I don't know where he is. And I swear to God, this voice said, try Ojai. Because, see, that's where they did all those slalom races. I thought, damn. I'm talking 40 years ago. I didn't remember that. It just came out of the blue. So I thought, okay. So I call up, get information. The first Bob Taylor that I called was not him. The second Bob Taylor that I called, a girl answers the phone. And where this came, it just came completely out of the blue. I said, is this Emma? And she said, yes, it is. And I said, you might not remember me, but I was Robert's roommate down in Hermosa Beach. She said, oh, I remember you very well. She said, you never approved of me. I thought, oh. Yeah. I always thought Robert could do better, you know. But anyway, she said, I'll give you Robert's number. He's working over, he was a Mormon then. He was over working at the Mormon library. And she said, he's in charge of all the records and stuff there. He'll be really delighted to hear from you, you know. So I called his personal number right there where he was working. And he answers the phone, and I said, Robert? And he said, Luther Wood. I would recognize your voice anywhere, you know. So we started talking and everything. I said, Bob, I need to sit down with you and Emma. I need to come and make amends with you. and I have to do this in person, you know. And he was living, like I said, in Ojai. So he said, I'll tell you what, we love this little Italian restaurant down here in Camarillo. And come down there and meet us, and we'll have dinner together, and then we can get all this done. So we did. We had the best goddamn time. We laughed and carried on in there, and I made amends with these people and renewed this friendship with them. And, you know, some of the sadness is, like, these people would like to be friends with us again, but we don't have time. I just don't have time to cut it all out. For AA is my number one priority, period. It goes above my family. It goes above my wife. It goes above all of it. Because without it, I don't have anything. So it has to take priority over everything. And most of the people in my life understand that. And so anyway, that was all. Now, I wanted to tell you something, too, because we talk a lot about being able to, and I made the statement earlier about I was able to make amends with my mother. You know, before she died. But there are times when it was a great idea, Sam, but I forgot to put it on start. we set my phone for 5 minutes. God, I forgot to hit the button. So I swear to God. Anyway, I'm always saying that I made amends to all these people and while they were living, and that's all very well and good. But I'm here to tell you something. We really are living in God's world, okay? This is either real or it's not, okay? And I have no reason to stand up here and tell you it's real when it's not, because it is real. Because it's been proven to me over and over and over and over and over again. It's undeniable. I cannot deny it any longer. So, my grandfather was sitting in his lap. I asked Sam when we first got there, I said, "Did you ever have a safe place, Sam?" And he said, "No." And God, his eyes filled up, and he couldn't even hardly write. He wrote me something on a napkin. He says, "I've never had a safe place." And that's another story all in itself. But my safe place was my grandfather's lap. My grandfather couldn't sing. He couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, but he would sing me "Bye, Baby Bunting" until I fell asleep every single night. And I felt the safest I've ever been in my entire lifetime. I would have killed anybody that tried to harm me, you know. So my mother and dad wouldn't take me to see him when he was dying. Because they couldn't, they weren't being mean, it's because I couldn't help myself. I drank all the time, every opportunity I got, embarrassed everybody, made such a mess out of everything, and caused so much trouble. They could not afford to take me. So I didn't get to see him, and he was the central most figure in my life today. In fact, I wrote him a letter at that time, and I told him in the letter, if there was anything decent in me at all today, which is even today, it probably came from him, because he was one of the most gentle, strong, but gentle men on this planet. You know, a man of integrity, a man of his word, just fabulous, fabulous man. So I wrote him this letter, quite a letter. And I also wrote one for my father, because I'd never been able to give my real father a direct amend either. So I got on an airplane, and I flew down to South Carolina. And I drove way out in the country in Saluda. Saluda's a very small little country town. And out in the middle of nowhere, and all these trees and forest and all that kind of stuff, is this huge church. I mean, red brick, white pillars, you know, plantation, southern, blah, 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 church. So, and around the church, the cemetery is around the church, you know. And so I'm out there digging around, and I find the plot. I find the family plot. And I see my grandfather's name there. His name was Loomis Shafter Harmon. And I knelt down there, and I said a little prayer before I pulled my letter out and told him I was here to read him something. And I started to read to him. And Halfway through the letter, I smelled him. I'd been in that lap I can't tell you how many times. I don't know what he wore. I have no idea. But I know what it smells like when I smell it. And I smelled it. And I knew at that instant something had come. Something had come and taken what I brought. I finished. Now, you can laugh at me all day long, but I'm telling you, I'm living in God's world here, and you are too. And I don't laugh at any of this stuff anymore. You tell me you got a God box, great, you know. Put it in there. Whatever you want to do, do it. However the Spirit moves you, you know, do it. So anyway, I smelled him, and I finished that letter, and I folded it all up, and I dug a little hole at his the head of his grave, and then I buried my letter. And when I got up from there, I was free, completely and totally free. And I knew something had come. Something come and done that, you know, taken that. So then I had to get in my car and go over to Greenwood, South Carolina, which was a city, nothing really like our cities, but big. And they had a different kind of cemetery out there. I mean, it was huge. Very, very well kept, you know, very well groomed. And it was raining that day. And I get out of... I parked my car. I found it to his grave, and I parked the car and waited for the rain to stop. And then finally, I get out and I kneel down just like I did at my grandfather's, and I pull out this letter and I start. You're going to read it, and I hear this voice say, "Don't read the letter." And I'm thinking, "Don't read the letter. I came a long way to read this letter." And I said, why wouldn't I read the letter? And because the voice said, because it's full of resentment. God damn it, I'd had that letter with me, drove across country with it, read it several times and didn't see it. But it was all full of, I'm sorry but you, blah, blah, you know? And I saw it. It was just like, boom, you know, it's all full of resentment. So I said, well, what am I going to do? And he says, set fire to it. Set fire to it. I'm in a big cemetery. I'll get arrested out here setting the fire. It says, burn it. And so I pulled it out, watered it up. I don't smoke. I had a pack of matches up here in my pocket. I wadded that sucker up and I put a match on it. It went up like that. And then I said a little prayer for my father. And I wrote a really, really nice note on the back of this little card, and I buried that in his headboard. And then when I went to get up, my father was an asshole, okay? My father was one of the most charismatic people on this planet. But he didn't have any sense of integrity or any sense of honor. You know, he abandoned me when I was 10 years old, and I really had never had a lot of resentment for him. And he was so charismatic. I mean, people followed him all over the planet, you know. He was like the Pied Piper. And so when I got up, I started to get up. I saw something. I hadn't seen it before. It was a wall that was as high as the ceiling almost that went around. It was like four corners of a type of a wall. And this huge, huge wall had all of these cherubs and stuff over the top of it. But engraved in it in letters this big was the Field of Atonement. And I thought, oh my God, my father's buried in the Field of Atonement. You know, and I don't know what about you, but by the time I got up from there, I thought, you know what, it's all done. It's all over. It's all forgiven. Every single bit of it is done. So, let's see. I'll tell you one more thing, then let you go. Because I told you in the beginning, when I had this list of amends and I had the stack of cards in front of me, I was to say a prayer every single morning. You know, please take me to my next amends and give me the power to make it. And then when I finished my amends with these people, I would destroy that in fire or whatever, you know, just like I did my fourth step. I was so respectful of my fourth step when I got done with it. By the time I got my eighth and ninth step done, I destroyed my fourth step. I took it down to Playa del Rey because you can build a fire down there. It was about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and I set a fire. And I began, and I prayed about it before I did it, and then I began to pass the pages of my fourth step through the flames. And as they lit up, I don't know if you've ever seen this before, but the writing lights up brown, you know, and like the words like stuck on my eyeballs, because I realized that all of my complaints, all of my resentments, all of the things that I resented those people for were things that I do. It was the most amazing thing that ever happened to me, you know. So on the my last amends was to my my sister-in-law in Chicago. And Pat and I got on the plane and went there. And then the first thing I did when I got there, I said, I'd like to sit down with you and the girls, because I owed them an amend when they were when they came to California. I didn't treat them well. And for whatever reasons, I just didn't treat them well. And so we sat in their kitchen in this booth. And they looked at me all the time I was talking with them. And it was so obvious that nobody had ever told them before that they actually loved them, that they were sorry for some of the things that they did, and asked them for forgiveness and so on and so forth. They were like blown away by the end of this amends. What blew me away at the end of the amends was that night when I went to bed. I didn't have to say my prayer anymore. I had said that prayer for the better part of 18 months. Every morning and every single night. I told you, I did this religiously, as if my life depended on it. I never faltered. And instantly, when I knew I didn't have to say that prayer then and there, I thought, oh my God, I'm innocent. Blew me away. I'm innocent. There's nothing on the blackboard. Nothing. I did everything I said I would do. I did it all. Every bit. You know, I knew, come on, I'm human. I write stuff on the blackboard, you know, for tomorrow. So I know there's going to be stuff down the road. But at that moment in time, I was innocent. I don't know about you, but I hadn't had that feeling since I was a child. I know about the innocence of a child. Okay. I'm glad to be here with you in the place, in this kind of a place, where we believe that the love of a child is equal to the building of a kingdom. Hello. We're all about that. We're all about love here. So when I determined that I had been returned to innocence, I can't explain that in a way that's even possible for anybody to understand, I don't think, except for me. I understand it. And I am so grateful for this program and what it's given me and the road that it's led me in and how it helps me to treat you and treat others and to be of service. And whoever thought that I was going to be useful ever in my lifetime? Whoever thought that you were going to contribute anything, you know, or be useful in your lifetime? And here we are, actually useful. People actually hear us. Like I told you, when I very first started talking last night, we hear each other. It's the most phenomenal thing I've ever seen in my life. We can hear each other. I can't hear all these people pounding on the drums and on the cymbals, you know, but I can hear you. I hear you if you're telling me your experience, you know, and I can identify with you. And I can know that I am not alone. And don't have to be either. So anyway, we're going to stop for today. And I think we did pretty good. We got all the way through 9, you guys. And nobody's too asleep. And so, okay, yeah, done. I'm done for now. And we'll see you tonight at 8 o'clock, right? Yeah.